My guest Jerry Labor led a reasonably conventional life until the age of 49, when she co-founded the group Helsinki Watch, which later became Human Rights Watch, the largest human rights group in the U.S. Labor has written a memoir called The Courage of Strangers, Coming of Age with the Human Rights Movement. Helsinki Watch was started in 1979 to help dissidents in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. Labor met frequently with dissidents and torture victims and helped them fight repression in their countries. But meeting them wasn't easy because the Soviet Union and their satellite governments didn't allow in human rights workers.
I had to go incognito. I applied for visas as a tourist. I listed my occupation as housewife. I had a handful of names of people to look up, which I had gotten through various emigre sources in the West. I had no idea whether they would want to meet with me or not, whether meeting with me would get them into trouble. I knew I could not use the telephone or contact them in any way, either before going or while I was there. And I just sought them out by going on foot without taxis, which of course were bugged, being as inconspicuous as possible and going to their homes. I would find the address, try to be sure that no one was following me, knock on a door, hand a piece of paper to the person who answered with my name and Helsinki Watch written on it, and then wait to see what their response would be.
Are there certain tricks that you learned to protect the people you were working with? You were bringing information, you were taking back information. Let's start with your memory. How good was your memory? What are the things that you could trust to memorization when you were taking in or taking out information?
I have a good memory, but there was no way I could remember everything I was hearing. These were new people, new names, cases, lengths of detention. I had to take notes, and I did take notes, because I risked the possibility of having my papers searched when I went back and forth across borders. I learned that I could write in a script so tiny that I couldn't even read it myself until I got home and either put it under a magnifying glass or enlarged it later on in a Xerox machine. So I made it my writing as tiny as possible, and I also coded people's names so that they were not immediately understandable if someone were to read it. And that kept my notes rather small and concise, and I would then usually go into some sort of panic before I was about to leave the country, because where am I going to put my notes is always the question. And I would contemplate all kinds of what seemed to me clever ways of hiding them, and usually ended up just rolling them up into a little ball and putting them in the pocket of my raincoat where my hand was on them, hoping that if I was searched, they would search my belongings and rather than my person, which is what usually happened. And on at least one or two occasions when my bags were searched leaving a country, I noticed that they went to all those clever places I had thought of, like the hollow end of a dental floss container and so forth. That's what were the first places that they looked. So obviously my instincts were not particularly original, and I was better off taking them out the way I did.
So did you sometimes have to hold it in your hand while your baggage or your clothes were searched?
Well, I had that sort of reassuring touch. You know, my hand was in my pocket. There was a crumpled bunch of papers. It was a deep pocket that within reach. I don't know what I would have done if they had said, take out your hands and gone into my pockets. I don't know if I would have taken them out with me and thrown them somewhere or just given up to the inevitable. There was nothing in my notes that would have really gotten anyone into trouble. I was very careful not to use their names next to their statements. So it was mainly that I would lose valuable information, which I could then take home with me, publicize, write about, and call attention to the people I was meeting with.
Several of the dissidents who you work with later became very important in the post-communist governments. In some cases, they even became head of state, like Václav Havel. You knew him first as a dissident, then he became the head of the Czech Republic. How did you know Havel? What kind of work did you do together?
I think one of the most memorable events we had was getting arrested together in October of 1989, just 3 weeks before the Velvet Revolution began in Czechoslovakia. I was hauled into a police station together with a bunch of other members of the Czech Helsinki Committee. And after we, none of us were held too long, after we were released, Havel and I had a long talk about what would happen in Czechoslovakia, how far off the revolution really was. None of us knew it was 3 weeks away. None of us knew that Havel would be leading it. It was a very special time in history. And the thing that was special in my recollection was that the reason I got arrested was because I tried to photograph the police arresting my Czech friends. And when I took out my camera, they tried to pull it away and ended up arresting me. And afterwards that evening, some of my Czech friends said to me, "Now you know. Now you understand how you one becomes a dissident in Czechoslovakia." Because these people didn't abstractly decide, "I'm going to be a dissident." They stood up for a friend who was being arrested. And in that short moment, I experienced what it was like to try to stand up for somebody who was a friend and who was being arrested.
This wasn't the life you'd planned on. It wasn't until you were in your 40s when your marriage was breaking up and your father had lost his fortune, the fortune you thought you'd inherit, that you started doing human rights work. How did one thing lead to the other? How did the total rearranging and changing of your life lead you into human rights work?
Well, actually, I had become involved in the human rights movement at a point before my marriage ended and before my father lost his money. So it was sort of there, but I was working at that point more as a volunteer than as a paid person. And my major occupation, my major commitment was still to be a good wife and a good mother and to take care, to run my home. And when things changed and I realized I had to find work, I did actually go out and find some work in editing and things that did not interest me very much but which did pay. And then through a chance encounter with a very wonderful man named Robert Bernstein, who was actually the founder and the first chair of Helsinki Watch and then of Human Rights Watch, we began working to form an organization to defend those dissidents in Moscow and in Prague and in Warsaw. I don't think any of us ever thought it was going to be even a full-time job for me or for anyone else. I did it because I really cared, and I thought I would try to make money on the side doing things that I found more lucrative but didn't really care about. But then the movement began to take off, and before I knew it, I was the executive director of a large and growing human rights organization that was beginning to be very visible and being taken very seriously by governments in many parts of the world.
At about the time you were scheduled to make a 25-day trip to Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary, and Yugoslavia, your father was dying, and you were really torn. You know, on the one hand, you wanted to be with your father. On the other hand, this was a very important trip. I'm sure that this is just a larger version of a typical decision you had to make, one to put the cause first and one to put the needs of your family first. Among other things, you're the mother of three children. Let's talk about the specific decision with your father. How did you make that decision that you would go on that 25-day trip when you weren't sure that your father would still be alive when you returned?
Well, of all the painful decisions I had to make between family and work, and there were many, as you say, I think the one I regret the most was having taken that trip at the time that I did. I was new in the professional world. I was under the impression that one didn't bring personal matters into the workplace. I was the only woman at that time in a world of men who seemed to keep their personal lives out of it, and I felt it would be unseemly for me to say, "I cannot go now. My father is on his deathbed." So I instead spoke to his doctor. The doctor assured me that he would be okay, that he was not declining that fast, and I decided to go. As it turned out, he died the night I returned, and I've never really forgiven myself for having missed being with him at a time when I think he really needed me.
I think, you know, something that makes it particularly difficult when you're in the human rights movement to make those decisions between family and the work is that the work is about saving lives. So, you know, you're weighing, well, you know, should I help try to save these lives or, do I help my three children, or do I be with my father on his deathbed? And I could see guilt and torn feelings and agony, no matter which way you turn.
Well, you're right. Speak to my children, and they'll tell you. But
Do you think they would tell me?
Well, I think they would tell you that they are very proud of me, that they really value the work that I've done. But they will also say that I really was not there for them at some very critical moments in their lives, you know, and I didn't always make it to the hospital when the baby was born. Wasn't always there to lend an ear when a marriage was breaking up, or just to be around as a good mom, when as I would have liked to have been and as I had been. In a way, I think it was easier for me than it is for young women starting out today, because I had two lives. You know, my first life, my first marriage, I had interest, but I was basically committed to my family. And so that when my children were young, I was there for them. The problem started later on, and they were already in high school and college at the time that my work began. But their needs were great at that time, too. And I think I tended to tell myself, well, they're growing up, they don't need me as much. This is time for me to do things, other things, and to try to make some sort of contribution to the world besides my family.
Have you remained close to any of the dissidents that you worked with during the communist years?
I have, and that's been a very gratifying thing for me. In the year 2001, I believe it was, I received a medal from President Havel on the Czech Republic's National Day in honor of the work I had done during the communist days. The Czechs and many of the other dissidents I worked with really do remember, and they remember their friends, and I've had a very touching little cards and visits from people who to this day are still saying thanks for what you did, even though things have progressed tremendously in this country since then.
How would you compare the techniques that you used to work for human rights when Helsinki Watch started to the techniques that the human rights movement is using today?
The techniques of the human rights movement today are very much more sophisticated than they were at the beginning. We use pressure through governments, through international bodies like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank, through international corporations. We try to use leverage in any way we can to get governments to respond to where their economic interests lie. It's no longer enough to just try to shame them by pointing out what they do. They have ways of covering that up.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jerry Leiber's new memoir is called The Courage of Strangers, Coming of Age with the Human Rights Movement. This is Fresh Air.